Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The following program is the fourth and final holiday season special, drawn from the Art Scene archives. In 2000, I received a book called Desert Sojourn, which appealed to me, and as the author Debbie Holmes Binney was on a book tour and coming to Little Rock, we arranged an appointment to talk. And our conversation aired on December the 15th, 2000.
When I first began to think of decorating the shelter, there, I really had an inner struggle. Did I dare do Christmas on my shelter when it would be mostly expected to do something real earthy or more in line with Native American desert themes?
Writer Debbie Holmes Binney, on a quest for some resolution in her life, spent 40 days and nights alone in the Great Salt Lake Desert, keeping a log of the procession of time and what happened to her within it. Her book, Desert Sojourn, chronicles that experience and how she survived. A few years ago, from November the 11th to December the 20th, she had some truly extraordinary moments, from life-threatening to soul-satisfying. One of the latter was just after she had touched rock bottom, and coming out of it created a Christmas celebration unlike any other. She had decorated her shelter with ornaments made on the spot, and seeing it one night from the outside writes, "After all those Christmas Eve services, I should have remembered. When it's dark outside and bright inside, the stained glass is stunning. My shelter is glowing. Until this moment, I thought that given my inability to string Christmas lights from cliff to cliff, Candyland could never rival the candy cane lane of my childhood. But I have never in my life seen anything quite like this. The gingerbread boys, the lollipops, the candy canes and gumdrops and hearts and holly, every figure is aglow, casting the snow all around in a peach halo." On her last night, all packed up and ready to leave the next day, she lights a final fire and hears again what the squirrel man, a hermit met as she was starting out, told her, "If heard, means your ears have learned to hear again." Again, she writes, "As the flames leap higher and higher, a deviant spark shoots 15 feet into the air and extinguishes into nothing with a soft sigh. It's so quiet that my heartbeat makes an audible ba-bump, ba-bump. And then I hear the long, low note floating from the coals. The first is followed by another, as if played by a pipe organ in a church. Five more notes follow, and then the melody repeats over. I tip my head back just as a shooting star blazes across the heavens, the first and only one I've seen in all the night I've watched the desert sky. A shiver runs down my spine as I wonder where I'll be the next time I see one. I wonder if I will ever again be where it is quiet enough to hear the music in the fire." When Debbie was in Little Rock on a book tour, we taped the following conversation, beginning with her choice of title.
I think it accurately reflects my purpose there. I sure didn't want to stay there forever.
Did you think out other titles?
I thought of one other title that I liked, which was Gifts from the Desert, similar to Gifts from the Sea by Anmar Lindbergh. But in the whole event of it, we decided that Desert Sojourn was more appropriate.
It's about 5 years ago, according to the epilogue. The years before that, the lead-in to this decision to isolate yourself. Obviously, right from the beginning, you had real questions about your marriage and what you were doing and where you were going with it. Looking back now, can you trace where it began, this realization that you had to do something very, very specific by yourself?
I had a very good feeling that something was going in the wrong direction in my life, starting about when I was 24 years old. And I'd been married a week before my 19th birthday. So probably about 5 years into my marriage, I knew that things were not great. It took another 4 years or so to make the decision to leave that marriage. And then 3 years after that, I spent trying to put the pieces all together. And when I had not been able to do that, either through counseling or through self-help books, at that point I decided to do something, drastic, I suppose we'd say.
Now, you had a remarkably rich childhood.
I did.
Your parents, the animals, the traditions, your sisters, your descriptions of Thanksgiving and Christmas, and how that in itself showed the culture clash between you and your husband when you prepared your first Thanksgiving dinner. And I wondered why, out of some of the chapters or segments in that book, you describe yourself in a way that makes you seem so lost, as though you're searching for something. You were the older of the three girls,
mm-hmm.
and along come twin sisters. Notoriously, twins are close. Did you feel in some way left out?
I nicknamed my sisters the intruders. Everything was just fine until they came along, although, of course, I can't remember because uh-huh. I was only 3 years old and my sisters were born. They are and continue to be remarkably close. As it happened, though, when I was growing up, I tended to be very close to one twin, then after a while very close to the other. So I never really felt excluded from mm-hmm. from them. I just felt like their relationship was something that I had to accept.
But, you sort of draw a picture of yourself as a rather lonely person in many ways, looking for something, even young as you were.
I think that's very true. I remember being aware even as early as maybe 5 years old. I was swinging on the backyard swing set, feeling something that I could never have identified, but mm-hmm. even then just looking for something.
Immortal longings.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. There's one phrase in description when you and your husband are getting to the point where you're having counseling, and your husband, you quote, as saying that she doesn't really want to be happy. She'll never be happy. He said, no matter how good things were, James said, I always found something lacking.
I really questioned whether what I felt mm-hmm. could be true, a kind of happiness that could last, that could actually feel whole inside. I began to question whether that existed because I really didn't see that many people that felt that way. And I felt that the message, especially from my marriage, was more accept what you have, don't look for more.
The back of the book is described as that you left behind a stifling marriage, but that's not exactly accurate. You'd already left that, and what set you into further searching was even after you'd moved in with Jerry and had this extraordinarily safe feeling with him, this feeling that this was where you were meant to be, but you still, it was almost like Ulysses. You had to go off and do something to be worthy of being back with him.
Oh, I like that word. I do. I think worthiness played a large role in it. Jerry had done something that I admired very, very much, and that was to walk those 900 miles along the Cherokee Trail of Tears. And in doing that, not only did he honor a sense of his ancestry and past, but he also, just in doing so, discovered things about himself that I could not help but think, because I did not know similar things about me, made me less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have a few experiences that draw you further and further towards this somewhat fateful decision to isolate yourself, to challenge yourself in circumstances even you didn't realize were going to be quite as challenging.
Right.
Though you chose November, which has to be a fairly ominous month in terms of weather anywhere in this country, I would think, wouldn't you?
Well, I had been told that it shouldn't be too bad until January, February.
Because the description of the storm and those early disasters, I'd have packed up and gone home the very next day.
Yeah, if
gosh.
I had known when I was getting into, I never would have done it. So yeah. I'm very glad I didn't know.
Well, that applies to most things, I guess.
I guess it does.
Now, you do describe, as the book progresses, your childhood. So you went into this kind of an experiment, adventure, whatever, with much more as a background in camping and dealing with the various challenges that the wilderness brings you than most of us have. So you'd obviously realize that you could handle most things on your own.
Yeah, I certainly believed I could.
Yeah.
Just from having, as you said, from having been camping in wilderness areas before, but not alone.
Now, in the book, you've obviously made all your notes and everything, and you go back and you put it all together, because I can't see how you wrote all that you wrote right at the time when you're describing it in the first person as it happens. There are various things, like your adventures with the mouse, that must have been put down after you'd had a chance to sit down and at least thaw out your hands and recover from your shifty regarding of the shadows.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Because while I was in the desert, I wrote only in my journal.
Yeah.
And I ended up writing about 800 pages in a journal. It wasn't until later, experience began to settle in, that I could make sense of it for someone else.
Now, had you kept journals for other parts of your life as well?
I had for the preceding 3 years, faithfully, and I had also at times in my teenagehood, kind of off and on, but certainly faithfully for the 3 years before that.
Because some of the descriptions that you drop in, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, you must have looked at the various things you remembered and what you had written as to where they would fit into the saga, the overall saga of this particular book. Descriptions of your childhood and growing up and your father and the animals and all the reasons you had some of the, I wouldn't say paranoias, except for when it comes to mice, but this had to be what kept the book brewing for a long time. In 5 years from start to finish, I don't know when you started it, but when you've got all this material, it must have been very difficult to figure out where to put everything, where to stop the story in the desert and almost give the reader a moment to relax while you bring in a little anecdote about Christmas or various things pertinent to your life before this particular episode.
It was a trick, and it took several drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And never having written a book before, I did find it difficult.
Yeah.
But also, you know, to be frank, such things as like on Thanksgiving Day, I was thinking about my family.
Mm-hmm.
And as Christmas got closer, I was thinking about my Christmas remembrances. So I don't think it's very far off from what was actually happening at the time.
Another thing that I liked very much was at that very beginning of the book where you're checking out your water bottles. And you're having that conversation with Wanda at the checkout counter. The unexpected sort of philosophy, poetry that you meet in simple people.
Mm.
Her little description of how important silence and solitude are. I thought that was lovely. Now, did you write that down, or are those your own words of you remembering that conversation?
I believe that's almost verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down what I could remember as soon as I got to the desert. I was keeping pretty good track.
Yeah.
And she was. She was one of those very thoughtful people that I genuinely think we meet most every day if we stop and take the time to acknowledge the role that these people play in our lives that we just pass.
But don't you think, living as close to the desert as she did, that it would have had some influence on her?
Oh, I'm sure. I've often felt that people that were raised in the desert or that lived there a long time would have difficulty living elsewhere. It's such a distinct environment.
When you finally settle in and you have to get used to the silence and the dark and the feeling, you know, night has 100 eyes. I have the same feeling whenever I'm in a lighted room without the curtains drawn.
Mm-mm.
That there are all sorts of strange, unexplained and uncounted dangers hovering. So after that 40 days, when you were fighting these inbred somehow deep fears, what's it like now? Are you still aware of the silence and the dark outside your little pool of light?
It's not as if I have no fears anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But especially during the experience in the desert, I learned how to face some of those fears so that when I am afraid of noises in the night, hopefully I can tell myself That's not something that's harmful. It is something that's just a natural animal or whatever it is. But I think it may be human nature to be afraid of things outside our pool of light. Maybe that's one of our instincts that keeps us alive.
When you get to what you could call the nadir of your experience, when you talk about this horrible darkness that is in you, and you start in the book, you know, as it starts, you mention your family histories of the people who've met their darkness and haven't been able to vanquish it, have been vanquished by them, the suicides on both sides. You said the horrible darkness within me that I've never felt before. And I wondered, had it been there all along, do you think? Is that, would it count for your years of seeking something else? It's a period when you obviously doubted your ability to survive this experience.
Yeah, and I think that another way to put that is a fear of failure, a fear of the ultimate failure, the fear that because I cannot find what I'm looking for, I will lose my ability to cope. I will lose my willingness to hang on.
Yeah.
And I had not ever felt that kind of darkness to that extent before of realizing I may just lose it here.
Well, that would, I think, apply to many people. They don't have to be lost or stuck in a mountainous valley in the desert to have those feelings of total uselessness, of that the struggle is more than is worth the effort.
And I'm afraid that it is universal in that everyone does have their inner demons, one shape or another, that are going to affect life, whether they're not in a desert or not.
It's remarkable how you got out of that, and that extraordinary bit of writing that you came upon in your diary that you never... Have you ever remembered writing it?
No. Of course it came from my hand. It came from somewhere inside me. But no, I do not have the recollection of writing it.
Makes you believe in guardian angels, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So once you were aware of that, it seemed as though you began always to come back. Because you never mention that darkness again once you start putting your house in order.
It seemed to be a real vehicle of strength to find that inside, a way out of the darkness.
You talk about isolation, that isolation is punishment.
It sure has been.
Yeah, but there are two types of isolation, aren't there? There's the one of rejection, of being cast out. Parents visit this on their children when they make them take time out or sit them in a corner, or a teacher will single a child out to punish them by making them stand away from the class or something. But you get the isolation that is chosen, you know, the hermit, the aesthetic desire to find more about oneself, where you seek out isolation. You mention the character who is almost an example of that, the squirrel man.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to talk to him at all since this?
No, I haven't. I have no idea what he's doing. I'm sure he's still there on his little piece of desert.
So you never had a chance to tell him that you heard the fire sing?
No, I never got to tell him. I suspect somehow he knows, but I didn't get to tell him.
That's an extraordinary experience.
It really was. I've never heard anything like that since, even.
And you've never heard any sort of chord combination that
sounds not like from the fire? No, the closest thing that I could even get to it in the description in the book was the sound of a like a pipe organ.
Yeah.
But so distinct. And the feeling of being able to hear it and know that this sound really exists, it just made I felt almost a whole new world open, that, wow, there are things that are there for the hearing if we can learn to hear.
And it happened twice.
Yeah, two times.
Once just as you were getting to leave, and it's almost as though when you got to that point, maybe you relaxed and some of the tensions that might have closed you to an awareness of what was around you. Well, the first time you heard it, it was almost a relaxation of despair.
It seemed to almost come out and save me at that moment.
It was just after you'd found all that nice dry wood and you built a really good fire. And so there must have been a physical response to your acute physical discomfort prior to that time, that relaxing, the whole thing changed for a minute.
It could be that, and it was a very, very, very quiet night.
Yeah.
So whatever the combination of circumstances are.
And you don't know, do you? On the public radio once in a while, they'll run recordings of taped sounds of the Aurora Borealis.
Oh, really?
And looking at it, you never think it would have a sound. But it's an electrical impulse, so it does.
Isn't that interesting?
And they've been able to record it. And there was a marvelous story not too long ago about a woman in Africa who taped elephants because she was convinced they communicated. Did you hear it? And she had the recording on through all the time that the herd was together. And there wasn't anything on it. And then she slowed it until it was so deep that it was too low to record for the human ear to catch. But the tape recorder had picked it up. And it was a language of sorts. They were communicating. So maybe when you're in circumstances like that, there are sounds that normally you would never hear because of everything else around you.
How interesting. I would not doubt it for a moment.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard about the Aurora Borealis being recorded. Oh, I'd love to hear something like that, because it is so fascinating that there are noises. Just because you can't see something doesn't always mean it's not there.
When you came out of that almost like death wish, and you faced it, you defeated it without knowing it almost, but you had this urge to create from then on for the rest of your stay there. The days seemed to fly by because you had things to do. You were painting, you were creating all kinds of things to bring your world back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you learn all those skills? Had you painted and worked with pottery in the past?
No, I really hadn't. I don't even really know why I brought paints out to the desert. I mean, I'm not an artist. I suppose it was because I had limited myself to the activities I would bring. I hadn't brought books because I thought, oh, that would be an entirely different experience to sit and read books for 40 days. I'd enjoy that. But I'd brought these few paints, and I'd brought a little bit of clay in case I wanted to make a pot, because it just seemed like something you might do in the desert. And as it turned out, the clay was what I used to make Christmas ornaments out of. And
you still have them?
Yeah, I do. I do. I've got them tucked away. Most of them are still in pretty good shape. Because I was able to bake them in the campfire, those that didn't explode during the process.
Yes, you described.
That was most of them, but I have them.
But no music? You didn't bring a flute or a recorder? You've never done much with music?
You know, I did bring a bamboo flute, but I didn't play it very much, and I don't really know why. That's why I don't mention it, because I have a background in music. I've played the piano, and I love to sing, so I would sing to myself in the desert.
Well, that's interesting that you didn't feel that you might miss music that you would like to reproduce your own, because the flute particularly is one instrument that you associate with the tribes in the desert, and so many of the reconstructed Indian music is flute, the solitary flute, that because it's solitary kind of accentuates the vastness of the space and silence around you.
Yeah, maybe that's why I brought it. And it seemed to me when I got to the desert, I had some preconceived notions of what I was supposed to feel and what I was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And that, for example, when I first began to think of decorating the shelter, I really had an inner struggle. Did I dare do Christmas on my shelter when it would be mostly expected to do something real earthy or more in line with Native American desert themes? But I really had to find what I was feeling in the desert, and over time I did. It was just my own version of the experience.
Well, if you think about it, the night sky and the desert and simplicity were the essence of the birth of the Christ child. And the gifts that are brought are obviously fairly basic, except for the three kings, which were missing in your story.
I could have used those three kings.
The other thing that is nice, you refer to the next 30 days when you realize that you've got 30 days left or that 30 days are coming, that suddenly a month is important, and you realize that it's not just the 30 days you're looking forward to. Your life has been made up in a series of times that you've lived through and learned from. Do you still have that positive awareness of, I'm here today, there's another 30 days stretching ahead of me, and I will do what I can with them?
I sure try to. You were mentioning before that I seemed a lost person beforehand. And that's part of how time gets away from, how it got away from me, not keeping track of what's happening every 30 days. And now having such a sense of direction in life and having things to market by, had the book coming out and being able to go and meet other people around the country. I do have a very strong sense of, this is my life. This is today. This is going to be tomorrow. Enjoy it. Make the best of it. Appreciate it.
Well, you've obviously, in your the chapter after you've left the description of going straight to see your grandfather, I was so relieved he was still alive, because there's an entry in the diary when you say to yourself, you write, you're going to make it up with him, you're going to get over this wall of silence that he's created between you. And as I read it, I think, thought to myself, I hope he's still alive when she gets out of this, because she has no idea what's happening to her family.
Right.
While she's in this isolated spot. So to know that you did, and you met him again, and you got through to him and resolved something that obviously would have left you with an emptiness if you'd never been able to.
Oh, it would have been so sad. It really would have. It took so long for me to say, I need my grandfather more than I need to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had died during that time, it just would have been heartbreaking. As it was almost, a small miracle that I got to talk to him anyway, since he had been so out of it.
Yeah.
And then just suddenly, just for that one little window, came back enough mentally that we were able to connect.
Yeah.
It was really a special moment.
And then that discovery of the written pages of the Christmas Carol.
When I found those pages, I just, this chill went through my whole body, and I just thought, Grandpa, you rascal.
There is something that happens in life that you can never explain, and some of us maybe are luckier than others that you can have a passage, a contact with other thoughts, other worlds, other peoples that are still swirling around us, perhaps.
Yeah, I tend to think that world is all around.
That was Debbie Holmes Binney. Her book, Desert Sojourn, is published by Seal Press, Seattle, Washington, distributed by Publishers Group West. That interview with Debbie Holmes Binney from the Art Scene Archive aired first December the 15th, 2000, and that is the fourth and last of our holiday season specials. These four holiday specials, which includes the annual airing of The World of the Willows, have all been found in the Art Scene Archives. I do hope listeners have enjoyed hearing them. I confess that I have. Happy New Year to you all. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.